Jeffrey S. Sutton has served on the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit since 2003. Before that, he was the State Solicitor of Ohio and a partner at Jones Day in Columbus. He has argued 12 cases in the United States Supreme Court and numerous cases in the state Supreme Courts and federal courts of appeal. Judge Sutton served as a law clerk to Justices Louis F. Powell, Jr. and Antonin Scalia, as well as Judge Thomas Meskel of the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. Judge Sutton received his Bachelor of Arts from Williams College and his Juris Doctor from the Ohio State University College of Law. Judge Sutton served as chair of the Federal Judicial Conference Committee on Rules of Practice and Procedure from 2012 to 2016. He has also served in the Advisory Committee on Appellate Rules. He was appointed to that committee by Chief Justice Rehnquist in 2005, and Chief Justice Roberts appointing him to be chair of that committee in 2009. Since 1993, Judge Sutton has been an adjunct professor at the Ohio State University College of Law, where he teaches seminars on state constitutional law, the United States Supreme Court, and appellate advocacy. He also teaches a class on state constitutional law at Harvard Law School. Among other publications, he is the author of 51 Imperfect Solutions, States and the Making of American Constitutional Law, The Modern Experience, as well as The Law of Judicial Precedent. In 2006, Judge Sutton was elected to the American Law Institute, and in 2017, he was elected to its council. We are delighted he could travel to be here with us today. Welcome, Judge Sutton.
Thank you for that kind introduction. Thank you to the Law Review for inviting me. Thank you to the state of North Dakota. I think I might be the only person here by choice. You all were born here. You live here. You're stuck here. I've come here by choice. I think I'm the only non-North Dakotan to be here, so I really want to be here, unlike the rest of you, perhaps. I also made another choice about North Dakota. My wife's mother grew up in Culm, North Dakota. Father Cecil Ferguson is how you'd pronounce it back then, lived in Bismarck for a while. So I not only chose to be here today, I chose to marry into a North Dakotan family. Thank you so much. The other thing I would say about North Dakota is, other than my own state of Ohio, I think this is the only state that has invited me back twice to talk about state constitutions. I was here a couple of years ago, so this is now my second favorite state. I'll be looking for a third invitation, I hope, in a year or two, but we'll see how today goes. Let's acknowledge some elephants in the room. It's a big room. There's plenty of room for elephants. Writing about state constitutions, talking about state constitutions, having a symposium on state constitutions can be a little humbling, even without COVID. I've got many stories to confirm the point, but I'll just tell you two. Story number one comes a couple weeks after this book, 51 Imperfect Solutions, had come out. I'm at church on a Sunday, and leaving church, and a retired doctor friend of mine, Dick Briggs, comes up and goes, Jeff, I heard you wrote a book. That's so exciting. Is it a mystery? I love mysteries. And I said, no, Dick, it's not a mystery. Well, is it a, you know, autobiography? I really like that, too. And I go, no, I don't think so. They said, well, what's it about? With a little frustration in his voice. And then with way too much enthusiasm, I said, oh, it's about state constitutions. Well, Dick Briggs is a very polite guy. He had no idea how to respond to that. So we had a long, awkward silence. And finally he said, you sure it's not a mystery? Fair enough. The second story is actually more humbling and cuts closer to home and takes me back to my North Dakotan wife, at least based on her mother's birthplace and where she was raised. So Peg, my wife, is a seventh grade English teacher. No surprise, she's quite good at grammar, always correcting my speech and writing. Gets annoying after a while, but I just decided to use this to my advantage when it came time to send the book off for publication. And I said, Peg, you know, I'd really appreciate it if you just gave it a read. I'm sure I've got some, you know, subject-verb agreement problems here, or split infinitives there, and it'd be great if you corrected this, and any other suggestions would be really wonderful. So I give her the draft on a Friday. She says she's really happy to do this. And by Sunday, she's just a chapter and a half in. Now, The first chapter is only 6 pages, so she's not progressed very far. And I said, Peg, you know, I thought this was a little more of a page-turner, and, you know, it is your husband after all, so a little more effort here. And she stops, she looks at me with way too much seriousness in her eyes and says, Jeff, I don't love you that much. So that's very humbling. So needless to say, read the book. You're going to love it. Now, my wife wants me to let you know that she ultimately did read the book. She does love me after all. She saw some points of it, maybe not all. But I'm not giving up on the state constitutional law thing. I'm actually working on a second book. I can't seem to give this up. I'm not sure what's wrong with me. Maybe by the end of this talk, you can give a diagnosis. But I'm going to organize my talk around my doctor friend's point that isn't a talk or a book about state constitutions, really a mystery of some sort or another. And I'm going to organize this around various mysteries of state con law and this my own interest in it. Well, mystery number one should be apparent is, why in the world would a federal judge care? This is my 18th year as a federal judge. I never get state constitutional law cases. I think by the time I wrote the book, I'd had one. I've now maybe had a second. This has no efficiencies with my work as a federal judge. So it's really bizarre that I would enjoy this. I can, you know, really deepen the mystery by, it's not just me, most federal judges see very few state constitutional law cases, so it's a very odd hobby for a federal judge to have. So why? What gives? Answer number one is, I had the good fortune of being the Ohio Solicitor General back in the 1990s, really a great break for me. If you're a law student, you really ought to think about working in the Attorney General's office. Wonderful job, and probably my favorite job in law. In truth. And that was the first time I realized the Ohio had a constitution. I started defending cases, not only under the federal constitution, but under the state constitution as well. And I found myself really puzzling, why weren't people talking about this? Why weren't the law schools teaching it? My law school, Ohio State, they didn't teach state constitutional law. And yet, these cases were big cases. School funding cases, voucher cases, tort reform cases, criminal procedure cases. I have to tell you, I lost a lot of cases in the Ohio Supreme Court under the Ohio Constitution. And maybe I wasn't a very good lawyer, but these were big cases, and it really made me puzzle why more lawyers, law schools, academics were talking about this. That was, I guess, explanation number one. But oddly enough, my real passion about state constitutional law comes from my experience as a federal judge. Not because I get the issues as a federal judge, but because I'm quite concerned about the path and future of the federal courts. What do I mean by that? Well, in one sense, being a federal judge is as good as it gets if you like to have influence, or put more crudely, power. My first year of law school was 1987. From 1987 to the present, I would say we have seen a constant upward trajectory of the federal courts handling more issues under the U.S. Constitution, resolving more core disputes, doing more things that the American people care deeply about. Now, because I'm a federal judge, you would think I would love that. It looks like my ship has come in. Great decision taking the job. You know, if you invest money, you'd rather invest more of it. If you have a job in government, you'd rather have more responsibility, more power, not less. So in many ways, I made a good choice. Being a federal judge is a very influential job. The one problem I've noticed after the last 30-plus years is the American people aren't fools. They may be fools in the short term, but they're not fools in the long term. And what the American people have come to appreciate is that the federal courts are exercising a lot of power, and the U.S. Supreme Court in particular is exercising a lot of power. And if you can get 5 votes on that court to support your position, you can do some very important things that people care very deeply about. Exhibit A, that the American people have come to realize how important the federal courts are, is our last presidential election. By too many accounts to deny, our last presidential election turned on a sufficient number of Americans choosing President of the United States as a proxy to fill one seat on a 9-member court. In other words, the election turned on a sufficient number of Americans thinking a vote for President of the United States was most importantly a vote about control of the U.S. Supreme Court. You can read all you want about 1776 and 1789. You can read about it for the rest of your life. You'll never see anyone saying that was the government they intended to design, one in which 5 life-tenured justices on the U.S. Supreme Court could make the key decisions in American life, sufficiently key that presidential elections would turn not on what that president would do as president, but what that president would do in selecting nominees to the U.S. Supreme Court. That's quite troubling. Why is it troubling going forward? What happens with this? Well, eventually, you know, the federal court and federal judges, whether it's Chief Justice Roberts, Jeff Sutton, can go around the country saying there is no such thing as red robe judges, blue robe judges, Trump judges, Obama judges. And I personally believe that's true. If you look at my court, 90% of our decisions are unanimous. But notice what has been happening in the last couple confirmation fights, whether it's lower courts or especially U.S. Supreme Court. We now have confirmation votes that are almost 100% partisan. In the Kavanaugh confirmation, just 2 votes switched. 1 Democrat supported, 1 Republican didn't. We're getting very close to a U.S. Supreme Court justice nomination process in which the Senate vote is 100% partisan. Does anyone think the American people watching their elected representatives vote that way are going to believe that the judges they're voting for are not somehow reddish or bluish, Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, originalist, living constitutionalist? How can they can hear what the judges say all they want, but how can they deny what their elected officials are actually doing? And the worst part of the whole problem is it's deeply rational. The federal courts are exercising a lot of power. The American people should care who have these jobs, whether it's at my level, the federal district court level, or the U.S. Supreme Court level. These are life-tenured positions with an awful lot of responsibility. So what do you do about this problem? My suspicion is we really have 2 options. Option A is the path we are on, and that path is one in which the court continues to exercise more power, and it's just a function of you get your rights, we get ours. Red rights, blue rights, and that's all you have. And it's the U.S. Supreme Court exercising more power, more authority, and the American people say, fine, as long as 50% of the time I win, that's good by me. But it ends, that particular story ends with a deeply politicized court and a court in which the American people see them as politicians in robes. Whether that's true or not, that is how they will be perceived. And then, when you need a court that can deliver a Brown versus Board of Education or something that the country really needs, you're not going to have enough credibility, trust that the court will do it, or perhaps a court that can do it 9-0. That gets very hard to do when people, there are a lot of expectations when people get put on that court. So that's path A. It's the path we're on. And my fear is that it ends in tears. We destroy this crown jewel of American government, which has done a lot of good in American history. Yes, it's made some mistakes, but it's done a lot of good, and it'd be an awfully terrible thing to lose and politicize. Path B has a glib solution and a less glib solution. The glib solution is I can solve this entire problem if all 320 million Americans read my book. The less glib answer is, why would I say that? And that's that my whole theory, and it's really what I'm setting up to talk about now, is that this problem is our problem. This is an American people problem. This isn't the justices' problem. It's not the U.S. Supreme Court's problems. We Americans love judicially enforceable rights. No country in the world, no country in history has embraced judicially enforceable rights the way we Americans embrace them. That is just part of our civics education.
And I think it's going to be very difficult to change that way of thinking about rights and constitutions. This is what we expect, and it's going to be hard for us to deny that. So my suggestion is we accept that, but change the way we do it. And the way we change how we do it is that we use the state courts more often, more forcefully, when it comes to identifying new constitutional rights. So that's really what I'm trying to get at today. Mystery number two. How did we forget about state constitutions? How did this happen? Every single constitutional guarantee that we Americans cherish or that you know something about originated in a state constitution. The greatest era of constitution writing in this country, indeed in world history, was before the fabled summer of 1787 in Philadelphia. It's from 1776, when the states break, the colonies break from Great Britain. They, of course, had to create charters of government. They did create charters of government. People like John Adams wrote those charters of government. The Massachusetts Constitution, 1780, still the oldest constitution operating in the world, and of course in this country. That was the era when the constitution writing was done. Philadelphia in 1787, I hate to put it this way, was a cut-and-paste job, or worse yet, an act of plagiarism. All that happened in Philadelphia was they picked and chose. They said, let's set up the legislative branch this way, the executive branch this way, the courts this way. We're borrowing from Maryland here, Massachusetts there. When they did the Bill of Rights, the first eight amendments, those are all taking individual rights from one state constitution and another state constitution. How strange that all of these federal constitutional guarantees, which we take so seriously, we rely on so heavily, somehow we've forgotten where they came from, and worst of all, forgotten that they're still there. Every state, of course, that's why there are 51 constitutions, the 50 state constitutions and the one U.S. constitution. So that's a real oddity. The answer to that mystery is hard to pin down, and certainly hard to pin down in a relatively short talk, but I'd say it goes something like this. The state constitutions were not forgotten for the first 150 years. As Justice Tufte pointed out, when you drafted yours in, what was it, 1889, when you wrote individual rights guarantees, there was no other individual right. There was nothing, the federal individual rights guarantees didn't apply to the states at that point. So the state constitutions really did matter for probably the first 150 years. And I think probably incorporation during the Warren Court era made them a little less relevant because people thought, why not go to the U.S. Supreme Court, winner take all, national right. And that probably had something to do with lessening the influence of state constitutions. I suspect it didn't help. Some eras in American constitutional history were not known for great rights protecting eras. Think of the Jim Crow South, that obviously brought disrepute on state courts and state constitutions as sources of individual liberty or, for that matter, property. But whatever those experiences, whatever those explanations, they make no sense going forward because going forward we do have two sets of guarantees, and there's good reason, as I hope I'll be able to show today, for taking them both seriously. Mystery number three is a pretty short, easy mystery to deal with and a little depressing if you're a lawyer. The mystery is whether American basketball players are smarter than American lawyers. And sadly for you all, I don't see a lot of basketball players here. The answer is the American basketball player is way smarter than the average American lawyer. Forgive me, but I'm here to tell you the truth, and the truth hurts from time to time. Why am I so confident about that? There's never been an American basketball player in the history from when James Naismith invented basketball on. I don't care whether it's CYO, seventh grade, all the way up to the NCAA tournament or the NBA. There has never been an American basketball player that was awarded a two-shot foul, missed the first shot, and chose not to take the second shot. That has never happened. It never will happen. In fact, the law students in the group, you can think of two different ways to deal with this problem, this level of ignorance that most lawyers have. One is you can listen for the rest of my talk, and I think I'll be able to correct this problem and put you on an even playing field with the American average American basketball player. Or when you're done with 3 years of law school, take a post-grad year and play basketball for a year, and you will then, this lesson will sink in that every time you get two chances to do something, why not take the second chance, particularly when the first chance does not work? So every time there is a state or local criminal prosecution, every time there is a state or local law that your client does not care for, you have two shots, not one, to deal with the problem. You have the federal constitutional guarantee, let's say Fourth Amendment if it's a criminal case. You have Article One, I forget which number, state constitutional guarantee in North Dakota for the criminal case. Use the search and seizure protection there. That's two chances, not one, in order to get relief for your client. And the same with any civil laws, as long as it's state or local. Fourth mystery. Am I right about what I'm saying? Is it really the case that there are two independent shots? Is it really true in my hypothetical criminal prosecution by a local prosecutor and your client thinks there was a search and seizure problem in the way the arrest, discovery of the evidence was conducted? Is it really the case that the North Dakota Supreme Court could take a different path from the U.S. Supreme Court in determining what search and seizure means? Particularly when sometimes the words are exactly the same. That's a good example. Your search and seizure provision has many words that overlap completely and for the most part is pretty similar to the Fourth Amendment. And the answer is most definitively yes. All the North Dakota Supreme Court has to do in that kind of case, it does have to honor the federal guarantee. It does have to honor the U.S. Supreme Court's interpretation of the Fourth Amendment. It can't reject that. The Supremacy Clause requires, it mentions state courts in particular, it requires state courts to adhere to federal interpretations of federal guarantees. That just happens to be the first shot. If you lose that shot, nothing prohibits the North Dakota Supreme Court from construing its search and seizure guarantee to be more protective, or frankly, to be less protective. It can go in either direction. I mean, oddly enough, they could convert the words of the search and seizure guarantee into numbers if they felt like it. No one has more authority, no one has any higher authority over the meaning of the North Dakota Constitution than the justices of your high court. If the people don't like it, they can, of course, amend the Constitution. They can elect new justices. But the North Dakota Supreme Court has a final say over every phrase, every word in that Constitution. It truly is an independent shot. It is not just a second bite at the exact same apple. It's a different independent shot. Next mystery, I think I'm at number five. Well, what would be the grounds for doing that? Let's say they can do it. You accept that there are two shots. It really is like a basketball game and two free throws. You grant me that the state court has the final say over whatever the North Dakota Constitution means. How does the lawyer pitch that argument to get the North Dakota Supreme Court interested in taking a path different from the U.S. Supreme Court? Because if your court is following the U.S. Supreme Court, it's one shot, right? Does everyone understand the stakes there? If you don't get them to think independently about it, you're not taking two shots. You're just going to miss it again because it's the exact same shot. So how is it that the lawyer convinces a state court to take seriously the second shot under the state constitution? Well, first is real easy. And, you know, I've already gotten the invitation to come out here to speak at the symposium. Thank you. I don't want to seem ungrateful, but I'm now going to give you an assignment. I realize how unenforceable it is, but you seem to be a group of people with a conscience, even virtually. And so here's your assignment, and I hope you'll do it within the next day or two. It might work to do it before going to bed. This kind of thing sometimes helps with getting to sleep. Pull out the North Dakota Constitution, and all I'm asking you to do is read Article 1. All right, it's not going to take you more than 5 minutes I did it while listening to some of the other speakers. It will not take a lot of time. You are going to notice it's just going to jump out at you. Article 1 of your Constitution, first of all, is where you put your rights. Stop and think about that for a second. At the U.S. level, rights came last. Structure came first. It's only 2 years later that the Bill of Rights even come into existence. The U.S. Constitution was focused on structure, organs of government, how this gets organized. In North Dakota, by the way, this is typical of the states. All states, to my knowledge, except I think Colorado and New Mexico are the only two that come to mind that don't follow this. Everyone else does what you do, is you prioritize rights. It is Article 1 of your Constitution, right after the preamble. And you've got one right after the other. And you're going to notice that the norm in your Constitution is that individual rights vary, the language varies from the language of the U.S. Constitution. Different words, different meaning. So the very first thing to do, the easiest thing to do, the thing that will take the least amount of time for your client, whether it's a criminal or civil case, is just look at the Article 1. You're going to find very quickly there are some explanations for thinking about this guarantee in a different way from the federal guarantee. Second explanation for the state court to chart a different path. History. Justice Tufte talked about history, fixed meaning, original meaning, contemporaneous meaning. All of that is so important, so essential. And by the way, I'm often asked, you know, I must have read thousands of state court opinions by now, and I'm often asked, you know, what gets state court judges? What excites them? What makes them want to take a different path? Obviously, text makes a difference, but history they love. There's nothing that'll grab a state court more. I don't care whether they're elected or not. Nothing will grab them more than an argument premised on a chapter in North Dakota history that speaks to the problem at hand. At that point, it doesn't matter whether the judge is conservative, liberal, red, blue, originalist, living constitutionalist. All state court judges are proud of their state's history. It just comes with the oath. It comes with the title. It comes with the disposition of being a judge. So the history will often really make a difference. And I guess I would say history and culture pull together. So your preamble mentions faith. A great way of illustrating that is to compare free exercise rights. You'll notice, by the way, your free exercise clause worded very differently from the federal First Amendment. But think about these states and a free exercise claim. Utah, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, Maryland. All four states were founded by religious dissenters. When they put in a free exercise clause in their state constitution, they meant business. They left where they were for free exercise reasons. They prioritized the point when they put it in their constitution, and the history and presumably the existing culture confirmed the point. Now think about the difference between a state court and the U.S. Supreme Court in dealing with that history. When the U.S. Supreme Court has a free exercise claim, can it look to the history of Rhode Island and Utah in deciding what the meaning of the federal guarantee is? Of course not. They're construing a constitution for 50 states, 320 million people, God knows how many localities. They can't customize, or at least they should not customize, a guarantee to account for one segment of the population, one area, one group, one class. That's exactly what they shouldn't be doing. They're construing it for the whole country. But can a state court customize a free exercise guarantee to account for the citizens of that state, their culture, their history? Of course they can. So that could be true in North Dakota with free exercise. It could certainly be true with property rights. It could be true with right to bear arm rights. And think about that for a second. What in the world are we doing focusing on one national court saying that gun rights ought to be the same in every pocket of the country, and that's the only way to think about gun right to bear arms? That's absurd. The right to bear arms, understandably, might mean something different in a very urban setting as compared to a very rural setting. Property rights, again, the use of takings clauses, eminent domain. Perhaps there ought to be a difference between an eminent domain in New York City, Manhattan, where land is I would say, pretty scarce. In Montana, where it's not quite as scarce, how could you want to live in a world where we have one rule for such diverse places? So the second reason the state court could try something different is because they can customize the guarantee, whether worded the same or differently, to account for your history, your culture. Third explanation, which I hope will surprise you because it seems a little odd, but it's actually one of my favorite points. State courts are allowed to disagree. I invite them to disagree with me. By the end of this talk, you'll realize there are plenty of reasons for disagreeing with me, and there are plenty of reasons for disagreeing with the U.S. Supreme Court when it comes to the meaning of things like due process, free exercise, free speech, equal protection, you name it. Let's drill down on what I mean by disagreement. Here's one obvious one. This applies in half the cases you will get. Half the constitutional cases that I'm talking about, what I'm about to say, is very, very true. Justice Tufte just gave a talk about how North Dakota Supreme Court historically has been originalist in outlook. There are a couple exceptions, but that seems to be the norm. Meaning's fixed. It's designed to constrain public officials. I'm not making a judgment call about this. I'm just responding to what he observed and described. If your case, we'll stick with the criminal procedure case, your Fourth Amendment case, if the federal guarantee is construed through a living constitutionalist U.S. Supreme Court decision or a pragmatic U.S. Supreme Court decision, the North Dakota Supreme Court should start with the presumption it's wrong. That, like, judges take methods of interpretation seriously. And if you tell me, and I happen to share Justice Tufte's views and your court's views, I'm inclined towards the originalist perspective, but that doesn't matter. But the point that does matter is, as a judge, if you tell me that was a living constitutionalist decision, I'm bound to be skeptical of it. That's not how I think judges should interpret law, but that's half the debate. There's the other half that thinks that's right. So the point I'm making is, if you have a claim, it's a two-shot claim, you remember the basketball player, you look at the state guarantee, you see the federal precedent, you realize it's a living constitutionalist precedent, you point out to your state court, you shouldn't be following this. It's not construing these words in the way you traditionally construe them. That's one form of disagreement. What's another form of disagreement? You know, the federal courts get it wrong. I'll give you just one example, and then I'll prove how many others there are. Think about tiers of review and equal protection. And I don't want to be too hard on federal judges. These are my colleagues, and I certainly don't want to be too hard on the U.S. Supreme Court. I report to them and just assume they don't reverse me any more than they have to. But I happen to think tiers of review is not one of the best doctrines out there. And my skepticism arises from being a law student, and I just couldn't connect the dots. It just didn't seem to make any sense to me. First there was rational basis, then there was strict scrutiny, then there was intermediate scrutiny, then there was rational basis plus. That, I'm up to four. Professor Tribe from Harvard says we now have seven. I'm really embarrassed to say I don't even know the last three. I've probably been reversed on one or two of the last three. It explains why. I didn't know about them. But let's just put it this way. If we have seven tiers of review, at some point, is it worth reconsidering? I mean, I do like seven. I mean, there is something to be said, you know, on Monday, the first day God said we'll have rational basis. The second day he said we have strict scrutiny. The third day he said we'll have intermediate. I mean, if you can make it biblical, it does sound, that's always good for judges to make it sound legit and credible. But other than the seven-day thing, I'm not really a fan of this. And does anyone think it's going to stop at seven? What hope of that is there? If there's seven, there's going to be eight. And, you know, it's not even the days of the week anymore. Why would a state court casually embrace tiers of review? And why would you, as a lawyer, casually assume that's what they should do? The state courts used to deal with this through something called class legislation. They had a bunch of doctrines historically. Go read Cooley's book, you'll see them. This is a great way to get your client out of a bind. But let me give you the best. You already are experts on coming up with arguments as to why state constitutions should be construed differently, and you don't even know it. But I'm about to tell this is worth like $10,000, what I'm about to tell you. It is so valuable. I'm just so excited I finally figured this out. Because my frustration, of course, is that the law schools don't teach state con law enough. And all they do is tell the single story about the federal constitution. And so I used to go around complaining about that. And I've now realized, wait, this helps me. Do you know why this helps me? Ask yourself how federal constitutional law is taught. As a federal judge, I'm quite sensitive to this, and I understand it quite well. Here's how federal con law is taught in every law school in the country, at least for the last 100 years. You read the case. You come into class. One student gives the facts. Not a lot of drama. What's the holding? A little more drama, because fight's about holding. But this is all by way of warm-up for the law professor, the federal con law professor and expert, to get you to the real point of the class. And the real point of every federal con law class, best I can tell, is for the professor and the students to identify all of the mistakes the federal judges have made. Let's read Judge Sutton's opinion. Where did he go wrong? He made this mistake, he made that mistake. And of course, I don't like this. I'm not even there. I can't even defend myself. It's quite agitating, as you can tell. And of course, what I like even less is it seems like the whole point is for the professors to show how much smarter they are than the federal judges and justices. Doubly annoying. But this has brought my ship into the harbor I have been waiting for the last 10 years. Because guess what this means? This means the one thing you know very, very well is you don't know what's good about Fed con law. You know exactly what's bad about federal con law. That is what you are an expert in. You are experts in why tiers of review don't work, why substantive due process doesn't work, why content-based restrictions on speech don't work. I can go on and on and on. That is the only thing you learned. Everything wrong with federal con law. What does that mean? Every time you have a state con law case, you remember what the professor said was terrible about the federal doctrine. You tell the state court judges, don't make that mistake. They'll probably remember the same lesson. Boom, you've got them. That's like the biggest, shiniest lure you'll ever use. It'll work every time. So you're already an expert in something you didn't quite realize. So the last explanation for why the state courts usually will be inclined to listen to you when it comes to charting their own path under their state constitutions is that the words we care the most about, the guarantees our clients invoke the most, and the ones we politicize the most because we fight so intensely about them, are the most generally worded. The key words in federal and state con law, the key guarantees in federal state con law, are all written at a very high level of generality. What process is due, what protection is equal, what speech is free, what exercise is free. They're constitutions, after all. They're written in very general language. They demand disagreement. The last thing that should be happening with such general language is one interpretation for the whole country. That doesn't make any sense. How can someone insist that there's only one way to think about due process for 51 constitutions and 51 jurisdictions? That is an absurd proposition. So the key thing for the lawyer is to make the point, hey, this is a general phrase, and the way to customize that phrase to our circumstances is to do A or B or C. So these general words become your friend. Mystery number six is, I think, where I am now. Why, what gives that, and this is not a criticism of the state, your state court, because I don't think they have this problem, but I will say, generally speaking, what I'm about to describe is the norm of state court judges in this country, and has been for about 50, 70 years. The norm is for the typical state court judge, when they get a two-shot case, is they'll handle the federal claim first, even though they're a state court judge. They'll start with the federal claim. They remember federal con law because that's all they had in law school. And then when it comes time for the state con law, state claim, and you try to say to them, hey, this is a second shot. It's an independent shot. It's a different shot. Give them all these reasons. The typical state court judge presumes that their state constitution mirrors the meaning of the federal constitution. I said the word presumes. I said it's not categorical. You can get them off that presumption. But presumptions in law are huge. Where people start as judges is often where they end. So if they presume the two guarantees are likely to mean the same thing, the odds are very high they're going to get there unless you do a really great job with the points I just made. Why do they presume that? Where does this come from? You know, some people think it's because they're elected and they want to say the federal courts, you know, when they do something controversial, they want to say the feds made us do it as opposed to taking responsibility. I don't know. That seems very cynical to me. It's not consistent with the state court judges I know. I actually think elections cut the other way. I think if I were an elected state court judge, I would be ashamed to be presuming that my constitution meant the same thing as the national constitution. That didn't make any sense. But let me try to illustrate the point in two ways and just kind of show how silly this is. And maybe this is a way you can, there's a way you can use this in your arguments. Think if I left the bench tomorrow and decided to run for the North Dakota legislature. I guess I'd have to move here and get some land, but why not? You've invited me here twice. I'll come third time on my own and get some property, leave the bench, and run for the state legislature. I give my first stump speech. I'm here in Bismarck. I get a few people to come. Maybe it's all virtual because COVID's still going on, and I'm all excited, and I tell people all the good things I'm going to do for North Dakota. And when I'm finally done, someone asks me, the first question is, you know, Jeff, I love your enthusiasm. Even though you're from Ohio, you seem like you're kind of like us. You certainly don't dress very well. That's good. I don't like uptight people, so maybe you'll fit in. And but I want to ask you a serious question. When you get a really hard problem, like you know, opioids is a big problem these days. Data privacy is a big problem these days. COVID's a big problem these days. Where do you go? Like, you know, how do you organize your thoughts to figure out how to solve this really difficult, new, challenging policy problem? And what if my answer was, oh, that's easy. Every time I have a really hard question as a state legislator, here's the very first thing I'm going to ask myself. What would Congress do? If I gave that answer, my political career is over. I just moved, I bought some property, I gave up the federal bench. I have no chance of ever getting elected to anything in North Dakota. There has never been a time in the history of any state in this country where you could answer a question about trying to run for state office by saying, I always look to what the national government does in solving problems for North Dakota or Ohio or Alabama or whatever it is. That is not what people want. They expect you to solve things locally. They're actually skeptical of the people in Washington. Guess what every state court judge in the country who presumes the federal constitution has the same meaning as their state constitution is doing? They're saying the answer to that question as a state court judge is what would the U.S. Supreme Court do? I do not think that is a tenable answer. If you disagree with me, run for the North Dakota Supreme Court and try it and see how it works. I don't think it's going to get you very far. And the same thing if you run for governor. You can't say, well, what would the President of the United States do to solve our problems here? Let me look at this same problem through an historical lens, which I'm actually working on the second book, and I've got a section on the Dakotas, which I'm excited about, and I've learned some stuff today. Is it Nick, I think? Yes, from Nick, so I'm going to use some of that stuff in the book. I'm pretty excited about it. It requires a little history, but I think you'll appreciate this, and I suspect North Dakotans like this part of their history. So if you weren't if you're not a state that was an original colony, that meant you were a territory. There are a couple exceptions to that. Texas, of course, thought it was a republic. But the bottom line is most states outside the original 13 colonies were territories for a while, often 10, 20 years. What did territory status mean? Territory status meant you weren't independent, you weren't sovereign. It meant you were an agency, a creature of the United States government. And what had happened is the United States government had said, in, say, the case of the Dakotas, this territory will be, this region will be called the Dakotas. We'll have a governor. We'll have a state high court. There were some complicated ways for creating a legislature. But the bottom line is you remained under the authority of the national government. The state high court judges were appointed by the President of the United States, Washington, D.C. What did that mean for the territories, whether in the Dakotas or elsewhere? That meant very often the territorial judges, that's what they were called, were not from the area. And their relationships, connections were usually on the East Coast, and of course with the president, his party, his supporters. People in the territories did not like territorial judges. The Dakotas very much did not like the territorial judges. One or two of them was in bed with the railroads, lots of corruption. Guess why many territories were very eager to become states? They wanted to choose their own judges. They didn't want carpet-bagging judges from the East Coast, educated at Harvard, coming to the Dakotas, telling everybody how to do things. They wanted people that understood their culture, their history, their way of living, and were them, were part of their community, neighbors, etc. Why? Because they would construe, well, first of all, it would, well, the other thing statehood would do is allow you to create your own constitution, your own rights, your own structure of government. And because you selected the judges as opposed to the President of the United States, it meant the judges would reflect your values. People like that. Guess what a state court judge should be described as today who presumes the meaning of the North Dakota Constitution is the same as the U.S. Constitution? There's a two-word phrase for that, and it ought to be an epithet. That is a territorial judge. That's back to the carpet-bagging judge that the Dakotans wanted to get rid of and every other territory wanted to get rid of after the 13 colonies. That was one of the impetuses for statehood, was to have this independence and not report to Washington. How ironic that we've come full circle and so many state court judges act like territorial judges. It just doesn't make any sense. It's very odd. I'd love to have questions. Well, I'll skip to one last mystery point. Okay, Jeff, all this is good. I get it. Two shots are better than one. I think I'll remember that. I'll try to read most of Article 1 before I fall asleep tonight. Thank you for that little assignment. But I still have in the back of my head that one big feature of American history is that there have been times in American history where it's been very hurtful that our individual rights were not uniformly applied across the country. So race is a good example of this problem. Jim Crow, of course. And it's easy to think of other instances where it would seem to be a very good idea to say that this constitutional guarantee is so important, it really ought to have the same meaning across the country. We don't want patchwork guarantees where search and seizure means one thing in Montana, another thing in North Dakota, still another in Ohio. And doesn't that undercut my argument? And because uniformity is such a good idea? And the answer briefly is no. Uniformity is only something you like when you like the underlying guarantee, and you'll tend to despise it if you don't like the underlying interpretation. Uniformity by itself is not a true value. The exception, of course, is if we're talking about something that actually is in the U.S. Constitution. I mean, if we're construing something that's there, obviously federal judges, and for that matter state court judges, shouldn't be ignoring it. But all these debates are really about the cases like substantive due process, where the guarantee is not clearly in the U.S. Constitution. In fact, it may not be there at all. It's identified through interpretation. And in those settings, uniformity is not necessarily a good, and in fact, it might be quite dangerous. One of the chapters of the book is about the search and seizure story, and in particular, the development of the exclusionary rule. The exclusionary rule is to remind you, is where if the police violate your search and seizure rights, say an illegal seizure or illegal search, usually the court will suppress the discovered evidence at the subsequent criminal trial. Now, the Fourth Amendment doesn't say anything about an exclusionary rule. Not a single state constitution says anything about an exclusionary rule. It's a classic example of something developed through interpretation, for better or worse, not taking a stand on it. But here's what I will tell you, and this kind of, I think, illustrates my point. When the U.S. Supreme Court created the exclusionary rule in Mapp versus Ohio in 1961 or so, this was one of the reasons they did it. They did it because they thought, boy, we ought to have a rule of suppression that applies to every prosecution, all Americans, you name it. So uniformity was really one of the driving forces for why they created the exclusionary rule. They didn't want a patchwork. At that point, about 25 states had exclusionary rules. The federal government had an exclusionary rule, but that left about 25 states without one. And so they thought it's time for one uniform approach. That's why they did it. Guess what the punchline to that Mapp versus Ohio story is? Do you think we have more uniformity in search and seizure law today than we did in 1961, or do we have less? Very easy. We have far less uniformity today. Why? What happened? What can go up in U.S. Supreme Court interpretations can go down. Since 1961, the U.S. Supreme Court has developed exceptions to the exclusionary rule, good faith exception. Since 1961, the U.S. Supreme Court has narrowed some Fourth Amendment interpretations, and most people are very happy that lots of state courts have filled those gaps. Uniformity by itself tells you nothing other than whether the person saying it prefers the right. It identifies nothing else. So the key thing for me, and this is where I'll close, and maybe a question or two, if I had my druthers, and this is, I guess, maybe the last mystery, why would this be good for federal con law? And the way it'd be great for federal con law is we need to go back to what Brandeis said. Brandeis said we have laboratories of experimentation. You have a new social problem. No one knows quite how to deal with it. It would be insane to pick one solution right out of the box to fix that problem. Imagine that with COVID. Imagine if the minute the problem struck, we said we have to have one uniform national rule to deal with COVID. No way. If ever there were an illustration of the virtues of federalism, it would be dealing with those challenges. So that's just, it's kind of the way you have to think about it. We have to do the exact same thing with federal con law. I don't care whether it's substantive due process, equal protection, free speech, you name it. If it's a hard issue, the U.S. Supreme Court should come last and not first. The vanguard should be the state courts. The innovator should be the state courts. When Brandeis used his laboratories of experimentation metaphor, he was talking about legislatures as the laboratories, and they could set the stage for the national government to nationalize a winning solution. My whole point is to do the exact same thing with state courts. Why not have the state courts be the innovators when it comes to this or that guarantee, this or that constitutional problem? Let the U.S. Supreme Court observe, let the results come in, and if there's a winning approach, nationalize. If there's not a winning approach, regionalize, and let different regions, different areas do different approaches. So I've talked more than I thought I would, but I'd love to get a question or two, or do whatever you want. I'm a guest, but thank you.
Thank you, Judge Sutton. Do we have any online questions? No. Any questions in the audience here?
Yes.
Hi. I hate to disappoint you with, because the question is actually not specifically about your presentation, but I was putting the pieces together because I recently heard a podcast.
Ah.
Yes, where you were
so
featured.
Now I have to tell still more people that I only got into one law school.
Well, Well, and I don't know about the, if anybody listens to Malcolm Gladwell's revisionist history. If you don't, you should. He's a wonderful, I'm getting a head nod from Alex down there. Malcolm Gladwell's, you should read his books. And he's not paying me to say this. He is pretty good.
Outliers.
Yeah, he's great. Good. Yeah, and he actually showed me the podcast. So, but you were featured on, I listened to it just, you know, I was a little late, but I listened to it a couple weeks ago, and he was, to give background, so he clerked for the Supreme Court, and Justice Scalia had talked about, you know, doing this path to get onto the Supreme Court, to be a clerk, and you have to go to these certain law schools and blah, 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 but yet his best clerk that he ever had was you.
I think he meant the best clerk he'd ever had from Ohio State.
Now with the podcast.
Guess how many clerks he's had from Ohio State.
Now with the podcast said, I think you're being humble. I think you were the best one, if I remember correctly. And so it was, and then they interviewed you for a little bit on the episode. So again,
Malcolm Gladwell's a lot of fun. He's a really clever guy. I think what he was coming from, it was a little bit about whether LSATs are useful indicators of who gets into law school or useful indicators about capacity for law, and probably realizing lots of people almost did what I did, which is take the LSAT and not do well and think, well, maybe I won't be a lawyer. In fact, now that I think about it, I've humiliated myself at the beginning of the talk, now thanks to you at the end of the talk. Let me. If I'm going to lose this game, I'm going to win by saying the most humiliating thing. So I'm ultimately going to win here, humble though I am. So I do take the LSAT. I have no idea what I want to do in life. Law was a third choice. I was a school teacher. I was thinking of foreign service. No lawyers in my family. I take this darn test. Do not do very well. I call my mom. What else is there to do at that point? And she says a very motherly thing, and then one of the worst things I've ever heard from anybody ever. The very motherly thing is, well, Jeff, maybe you shouldn't be a lawyer, but I think you should take the test again. It's probably not a good idea just to be defeated. You know, have a little grit, try again. That's good for mom. And so the conversation's winding down. She's helped me feel better about this. And I say, well, you know, mom, I guess if there's a silver lining in this, it's going to keep me humble, this low LSAT score. And she goes, oh, Jeff, you already have so many reasons to be humble. My mom. I mean, I don't know, where do you go with that? Can anybody outdo me on humility here? More humbling moments. But I think Malcolm Gladwell is quite right about the LSAT being overstated as an indicator. And my little advice point would be law is always for the turtle. It's all hard work. It's all sweat. It's all effort. And the good news is after 10 years of that, this is a Malcolm Gladwell point, or 10,000 hours, 10 years, I guess at the big law firms, 3 years, it gets easier. It does get easier. The problem is you'll get better and more people will want your time, but I love this career. First lawyer in my family, I love law. I loved it in practice. I loved it in government. I loved being a judge. It's an awesome career. But it is, you do have to work hard. It's not like some jobs where once you learn one little thing, it's easy. But what's great about it is it's stimulating. I mean, you keep wanting to do stupid things like write books about state con law. So I must love it, huh? Any other questions? Or I know we have another speech or talk. So I'm so grateful to be invited. I really have enjoyed this. And good for you in doing a symposium on state constitutional law. Congrats to the editors of the Law Review. And gosh, talk about grit. I mean, how many times did you must have thought about, maybe this isn't such a good idea. God is telling us something. But you persisted, and now you know something about state con law. Good for you. Thank you.
Thank you.